The next case on our calendar today is State of Minnesota versus Jude O'Neill. Good morning. Welcome to the Court of Appeals. Each party will have 15 minutes for your argument, and appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. Take whatever time you need to get settled, and when you're ready, you can proceed. If you would please identify yourself and the party you represent for the record and the recording, we'd appreciate that.
Good morning, Your Honors. Opposing counsel, may it please the court. My name is Travis Kyle, and I represent the appellant, Jude O'Neill. I'm here today with his adoptive mother and adoptive grandmother. We're here to ask the court to overturn his conviction because the court did not give proper weight to the evidence presented at the competency hearing. It's undisputed that Mr. O'Neill suffers from significant cognitive deficits. The court in this matter essentially ignore Dr. Reitman and felt like Dr. Federici, the clinical psychologist, did not give proper weight to either side.
Explain the standard of review.
Your Honor, I think the standard of review, the way I understand it, is that this court would look at it to determine whether or not the district court gave proper weight to the evidence, as the state has to prove by a preponderance of the evidence.
And what does proper weight mean? I know the Supreme Court has used that term twice now, at least. Have you found in your research a definition of that standard?
I have not found a definition. In my understanding, the way I see it in my research, is that this court looks at the evidence that was presented at the competency hearing to determine whether or not proper weight was
given.
What's
proper? What's the definition of proper?
Well, in my opinion, proper weight is looking at all the evidence and all the testimony provided and providing an analysis that is supported by the evidence.
So it's more like an abuse of discretion standard, or is it more like a de novo review standard?
My understanding, it's more of a de novo review standard.
The Supreme Court's never used the term de novo review. Are you aware of any other competency evaluative process where our review is de novo, where you've got witnesses, competing experts, testimony, and we're supposed to take a de novo look at it?
I am not, Your Honor. From what I cited in my brief, it's my understanding that, again, it's the proper weight, and the way that I interpret it is this court is to look at the evidence presented at the district court level. And in Mr. O'Neill, the appellant situation, it was two court-appointed forensic psychologists along with a clinical psychologist who specializes in adolescence. And here, Dr. Reitman was court-ordered in Maurer County to do several Rule 20 evaluations and found the appellant not competent.
So what is the proper weight that the district court should have given Dr. Rogstad's opinion, and what is the proper weight the district court should have given Dr. Reitman's opinion?
Well, I think what the court relied on in its order was saying is that Dr. Reitman is contradicted because he says one thing in one report and another thing in another report. But to me, that's one of the points of having a evidentiary hearing, is because the district court says Dr. Reitman's opinions, his written opinions, were conclusory, and in one opinion says one thing, but another thing mentions, like in this case, appellant's chemical dependency treatment provider, referred to him as Michelle, and then referred to her as Carol. So she says, I couldn't really give the credibility to Dr. Reitman. But that's the point of an evidentiary hearing, is to provide additional information and testimony. And Dr. Reitman at the evidentiary hearing said, I don't find appellant competent. He can't understand. He can't process information. He's not going to get better. My recommendation is to send him to some kind of a competency restoration program or something equivalent, because in his opinion—
Was there such a thing available?
No, there's, the competency restoration program is no longer operating.
So why would it then be proper to rely upon Dr. Reitman's opinion?
He's using it as an example because what he said is there's two types of assessments. There's a psychometric assessment where you're providing tests to an individual. You see them on a limited basis, a couple hours here and there. Or there's a functional assessment. And the functional assessment is more scientifically valid. And that's...
Can't you do both types of assessments?
You can do both. Yeah. But the functional assessment is where you really understand an individual, because the psychometric assessment, you're just giving written tests, and based upon those tests, you come to a conclusion. But as Dr. Reitman said and testified to, is when I would go out and speak to collateral sources and went to his treatment provider, they corroborated the tests that I'd given the appellant.
By what standard do we judge Dr. Reitman's approach proper and Dr. Rogstad's approach and report improper?
Well, I think you look at the collateral information. I think that is the crux of this case, because...
I'm just looking for a standard of law. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but Dr. Rogstad didn't just look at the evaluation directly, but wondered how it is, why it would be that there would be such a change from a previous report, and therefore conducted additional tests to determine whether or not your client was apparently being truthful and honest, forthright in the evaluation,
yep.
And concluded, no, there was malingering, feigning, not being accurate in responsive, which would go to the quality of the results of Dr. Reitman's report and even Dr. Rogstad's own report, wouldn't it?
To a certain extent, and that's one of the issues with Dr. Rogstad in terms of her credibility in this, is that when she was asked at the competency hearing, do you understand fetal alcohol spectrum disorder? And she says, it's essentially, I'm paraphrasing, but I understand what it is, but anything above a certain level, I don't understand. And one of the issues with FASD, and it's undisputed that the appellant suffers from this disability, which is irreversible, is that they tend to confabulate, which means they give false positives, they lie, they don't understand they're lying, they just answer questions just to answer questions.
So I've got a question, though. So we're looking at the legal standard for competency, because it seems like where Dr. Rogstad and Dr. Reitman differ is kind of on levels of cognition, where Dr. Reitman's testimony was, sure, if you ask a rote question often enough and tell him what the answer is, he can give you the right answer. But in terms of higher levels of cognition, if you change that up at all, he's got a problem, and I believe that means he's not competent. So just the diagnosis alone is not conclusive, or else everybody with FASD would be incompetent automatically. So what is that legal standard? What is that level? And more specifically, where in case law can we find the guidance?
I think the case law, there, again, it's giving proper weight. And as the, you know, Rule 20.01 Subdivision 2 says, is that whether or not the defendant can rationally consult with counsel or understand the proceedings or participate in his defense, which is essentially an open-air question. And that's where Dr. Federici, his testimony is critical. Although he's not giving an opinion as to appellant's competency to proceed in the legal arena, he can do that from a neuropsychological standpoint. But as Dr. Federici testified, appellant is essentially a 6 to 9 year old child mentally, which would equate to a first through fourth grade individual, but he cannot learn. So imagine going to an elementary school and taking a child from one of those grades and putting them in a courtroom proceeding. Yes, that child, if with normal cognitive abilities, could probably learn and understand the players, what a judge does, what the attorneys do, a jury. But to process the information throughout a trial and learn that new information, yes, that child could learn that information eventually. But here, appellant does not have that capabilities. He cannot retain information. He cannot learn. And that's what's critical with Dr. Reitman by going to his chemical dependency treatment provider was to get third-party sources and do the functional assessment. And when he spoke to the essentially appellant's aide, because appellant just couldn't be in treatment by himself, they had to specifically assign him an aide to help him through the process. And when Dr. Reitman spoke to the aide said he cannot retain information, he cannot learn information. When things get too stressful, we have to kind of basically hold him down and keep him there because he wants to run.
What cases are there that discuss the level of assistance you have to be able to give counsel, you know, or the rest of the competency standard to understand, I mean, to help inform us based on what's in the record here, is that enough? And the district court obviously thought it was enough, having heard all the testimony and read all the reports. But what guidance do we have in terms of what is enough of a level of cognition?
Well, I think
because you're kind of suggesting that this is a permanent condition.
This is a permanent condition. Yeah, I mean, yeah. This is the issue with the appellant is, mm-hmm. you know, appellant's mother, as Dr. Federici testified, has been years pounding the table asking for help. And in fact, Dr. Reitman said he needs to be civilly committed. And when he in Maurer County. And when he was sent over to civil commitment in Maurer County, they essentially laughed at the appellant and said, get out of here. Mm-hmm. And they did nothing with that. And what happens is people, individuals with FASD, even Dr. Rogstad acknowledges that they continue to usually commit the same offenses. And in fact, Dr. Rogstad said, I don't find him a danger to society. But since this case, appellant has three pending cases where there's a stolen vehicle and drugs involved. Because it's his permanent condition that this is where he's at. And I think this all supports what Reitman and Federici testified to. Because Rogstad felt like, she even says, he has the capacity to learn. When in fact, Dr. Federici completely contradicts that, saying he cannot learn.
Well, going back to the standard of review, it sounds like you're asking us to make a credibility determination and to find Dr. Reitman more credible than Dr. Rogstad, because Dr. Rogstad's evaluation in 2015, she found that he was able to discuss legal options and hypotheticals and understand the process, so she came to a different conclusion. And so is it our role to make a credibility determination, or do we give deference to the district court's credibility determination?
Well, I don't think it's necessarily a definition of credibility, because even Dr. Reitman and Dr. Federici acknowledge that the appellant has a basic understanding of the courtroom proceedings. In fact, Dr. Federici says what this is what we call incidental memory. He's got a root understanding of the courtroom proceedings because he's been in and out of jail so many times that it's there. Like, he knows incidentally what necessarily the players are. But anything above that, he's going to be lost. As Dr. Reitman said, he's going to be swimming in a sea of inadequacy. And what Rogstad basically says is he understands the players, he can learn, but he can't learn.
But Rogstad says something more, and I guess that's the part that I'm stuck on. Dr. Rogstad focused a separate analysis on whether your client was being forthright in being evaluated. So if Dr. Rogstad is correct that your client was tending to feign incompetence, doesn't that reasonably call into question Dr. Reitman's conclusions?
Well, I think what the court doesn't address and what also doesn't go into Rogstad's findings is what a clinical neuropsychologist says. And as Dr. Federici testified, is that this is an individual who, from his 2009 to 2016 evaluation, was deteriorated 20 to 30%, and in fact will only continue to get worse. Not only will it get worse, he's on the road to dementia, but any continued drug use will exacerbate that. If he's not getting proper treatment, or getting any kind of care, it's going to continue to get worse. So the court, what Rolstad doesn't factor in is that years, 2 years have passed since she last saw the appellant. So she's not, in her evaluation, there's no mention that, hey, he may have got worse. She just feels that he may be feigning or malingering, which is often misinterpreted with individuals with FASD.
Did Dr. Reitman look at the psychometric testing that Dr. Rogstad did?
Yes, initially he did the testing, and Dr. Reitman had testified in terms of the malingering aspect. He said, I didn't do the malingering test because if I felt like he was malingering, I would have issued the test. But
he didn't question the results of the test that she administered in any way, that she improperly administered the tests or that the results were incorrect?
Not in terms of how they were administered, but he did, after Dr. Rogstad had testified, did get on the stand and talk about malingering and how he had felt malingering is not an issue with the appellant because, again, he may have a root understanding of everything. However, he just is not going to learn, and anything above basically knowing the basics, he's going to be swimming in a sea of inadequacy and be lost and want to get up and run. I see my time is running out, so thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
A little short.
That's why it's adjustable, to accommodate all heights.
May it please the court, my name is Rebecca Barbario, appearing on behalf of the state in accordance with the student practice rule and under the supervision of Jonathan Schmidt, who is present in the courtroom today. The issue before the court today is whether the district court's finding that appellant was competent to proceed to trial is adequately supported by the record. For the following three reasons, illustrate how the record supports the district court's finding that appellant could rationally consult with counsel, understand the proceedings, and participate in his defense, and was therefore competent to proceed to trial. First, appellant's behavior in his first two evaluations with Dr. Rogstad demonstrate his competence.
Can I take you back to the foundation? Proper weight. Where did that standard of review come from, and what does it mean?
I cited in my brief to State v. Gonpat, which cited to State v. Mills, I believe. Proper weight, as defined there, is give proper weight to the evidence produced if the finding of competency is adequately supported by the record.
Oh, so you believe proper weight means it's adequately supported by the record?
Correct.
So it's a clear it's a clearly erroneous standard that we're actually applying.
And while I don't find that clearly stated in any case law, that is what I believe the standard to be when determining credibility and testimony of witnesses.
Now, that's interesting because, I mean, that seems to make sense to me, but the Supreme Court in, Gonpat?
Yes.
Made it sound as if there's two different elements, and it was quoting Mills, which suggests perhaps two different elements or two different levels. One, and I'll just read to you from Mills. We therefore hold that the trial court gave proper weight to the evidence relating to competence and that its finding of competency is adequately supported by the record, as if there are two separate elements to the review. And Gonpat seems to have jumped from there to actually saying, here are the two, not like they're not just one, clearly erroneous, which the second element would be, that findings are adequately supported by the record.
That is correct.
Were you able to find this term proper weight applied anywhere other than in these cases?
I was not, Your Honor.
What about referred to anywhere else?
I was not.
All right, but it's your view that the and really means therefore, that we therefore hold that the trial court gave proper weight, or maybe because its finding of competency is adequately supported, not and.
I believe the and is purposeful. I believe it's there. That the court would give an independent review to determine proper weight, but that proper weight is defined by adequately supported by the record.
Then you've lost me. So it sounds like you're saying then two different things. If the and is purposeful, then you've got two separate things. You've got proper weight on the one hand, and separately, finding supported by the record. as opposed to what you, I thought you originally were saying, which was that you believe proper weight means that the finding is supported by the record.
And while I couldn't find any definition of what proper weight meant or any sort of test, I believe that findings, the finding of competency adequately supported by the record would allow the court to determine where the weight is.
So the and does not mean two separate things. It means one thing.
I think the and, what I read it, is more connecting the independently review of the record to determine the proper weight, and that the proper weight would more be defined by adequately supported by the record, if that makes any sense.
You've got more to your argument, so I'll let you
yes.
go on with it.
Thanks.
I won't answer whether that makes sense, because I'm lost as to how the, it seems like the district court jumped, or the Supreme Court sort of jumped from a colloquial reference to a new standard, which hasn't been applied anywhere other than these two cases, but maybe I'm wrong about that.
It is a standard that seems to combine two different standards at the same time. Going back to appellant's behavior in his first two evaluations with Dr. Rogstad, Dr. Rogstad found appellant to competent to proceed after all three evaluations with him. And in the first two, appellant demonstrated his competence. He was able to name the participants in the court and describe their respective roles. While this may be root memorization, she also dug a little further, and he was able to intelligently discuss hypotheticals in criminal cases, including plea negotiations, and when she gave him new facts, he was able to weigh those facts.
And this wasn't in 2018. This was back in 2016 or 2015?
Correct. These are the two evaluations prior to the one for this instant case. The second reason, though, that demonstrates his competence is his behavior in the evaluation for the instant case, the 2018 evaluation. Appellant's changed behavior, as well as Dr. Rogstad's supporting reports and testimony, support the finding of competency.
But her most recent report on the malingering is just that he was malingering. I mean, he didn't otherwise answer questions. He didn't. It's like, well, my testing shows that he's malingering, so therefore I find him competent. Is there any testimony saying that a malingerer is automatically competent, or any case law? I mean, that's kind of her most recent, and we've got the other side saying that he's deteriorating over time.
So
we're really left with her earlier evaluations of competency then, aren't we?
Even in this evaluation, although he did answer I don't know or I don't understand to most of the questions, mm-hmm. he was able to demonstrate his understanding through his questions later on. And that's what Dr. Rogstad did submit in her report. For instance, he would say he didn't understand the role of the jury, but then ask questions that were very insightful to the role of the jury, including, what if someone from the community knew something about this case? Wouldn't that be bad? Putting those two together is why Dr. Rogstad administered those psychometric tests to determine if he was malingering or not, because she did feel that while he was saying, I don't know or I don't understand, he actually did demonstrate that he did, in fact, understand.
Does that mean that the 2016... What's your position then on the 2016 Rogstad report, that because he was malingering in 2018, that report stands on all fours and that's the one that should be relied upon to determine competence?
In all three reports, Dr. Rogstad found him competent to proceed. And so relying on his behavior in the first two and along with his behavior in the third with a changed circumstance, and again, that circumstance kind of comes from the intent to malinger, which... Actually, Dr. Reitman wrote in his own report that he spoke with the staff at his treatment facility, appellant's treatment facility, and appellant had said to one of them, I'm afraid of being found competent because if I do, I will go to jail. So with all of that evidence, it's actually that all three supports stand on their own, but put together, it gives support to the record in which the district court found that he was competent to proceed.
Appellant argues that... The evidence shows that appellant's counsel argues that the evidence shows that appellant is has a mental range equivalent to a second to fourth grade level relative to his memory, learning, and processing abilities. That's at page 23 of appellant's brief. So, do you agree that the record reflects that his cognitive abilities are in the range of a second to fourth grader?
I think viewing at the entire record, there's actually some inconsistency to that. For instance, even Dr. Reitman's reports were inconsistent on whether or not he's able to, or he's permanently cognitively impaired, or if he was actually able to, if he was able to, his competency was restorable. I apologize. So there is a lot of inconsistency on where appellant lies within.
How does that bear upon the age limit of his cognitive abilities?
I believe that he can present at different ages and different abilities throughout time.
When you say you believe that, are you saying that Dr. Rogstad stated that, or that's just your impression from the report?
That's my impression of, I guess, mental illness in general.
Your impression? How do we know
that? The impression that mental illness can change throughout time and that these reports need to be submitted.
How do we know that was the impression of any of the experts in this case? Isn't that what matters?
Yes. I do not know off the top of my head whether Dr. Rogstad gave an age limit to the appellant.
So if I understand you correctly, you are acknowledging that there is no evidence that you can cite in the record that disputes the cognitive age level that Dr. Reitman ascribed.
Not that I can cite right now.
And if he is functioning at that cognitive age level, how would he be able to rationally consult with counsel or understand the proceedings or participate in his defense? What record evidence would there be to support that?
The record evidence is through Dr. Rogstad's reports and testimony that he was able to discuss hypotheticals with her. He was able to ask insightful questions, and he was able to describe the court processes, which is how she, as a court-appointed evaluator, would evaluate if a potential defendant could participate in his defense and understand the proceedings.
But what do we do as a court here, as the appellate court, when it seems like you've got two forensic psychologists who are using different standards for what's competent? I mean, in some ways, they don't disagree with each other all that much. It's one is saying to be competent, you actually need some of these higher cognition skills, and the other is saying, I'm satisfied that this is good enough.
I think this court just looks at whether the district court's finding, again, is adequately supported by the record. And this is similar to the case in Gonpot, where there were three different evaluators, and that all gave different or that had different opinions on whether the appellant in that case was competent to proceed to trial as well. And here we have two evaluators. Dr. Federici is not able to make a determination as whether appellant is legally competent to proceed or not. His reports were reviewed by Dr. Rogstad and by Dr. Reitman and were incorporated there, but he wasn't able to opine to the ultimate question. So here we have two different opinions on whether or not someone is competent to proceed, and that's where the district court comes in and held a competency hearing in order to determine credibility and weigh that evidence to make sure that they had that the court had an accurate picture of appellant's mental cognitive abilities.
The district court seemed to discount Dr. Reitman's reports because they were short and conclusory, and it was unclear how he used the data points that he relied on to reach his ultimate decision of incompetence. Can you speak to that a bit and whether you think that is a correct determination?
Absolutely. Dr. Rogstad's report for the instant case was 17 pages. Contrary to opposing counsel says, the record actually shows that Dr. Rogstad did reach out to collateral sources, including Dr. Federici's reports, Dr. Reitman's reports, records from appellant's treatment centers and hospitals, as well as interviews with his counsel, prosecuting attorney, his mother, and his grandmother. So there was a lot of collateral information, and she actually detailed how she used that information to reach her ultimate conclusion. The district court noted that Dr. Reitman's report was much shorter. He reached his ultimate conclusion but did not show how he used that collateral information, and also that there was not a thorough examination of the appellant. So he did not administer any tests to the appellant during his third evaluation, and during testimony said he did not think it was necessary since he had done so twice already.
Is
and he also did not test for malingering.
Is there any requirement that he administer tests? I mean, is there any reason that should be given any weight?
I think the fact that one evaluator in the latest evaluation gave more tests and did a thorough evaluation as if it was back to the beginning, it gives a little bit more weight to that evaluation and that report. again, Dr. Reitman did not test for malingering, even though he was aware that, according to his own report, that appellant was being afraid or was afraid of being found competent. And then again, Dr. Reitman's contradictory statements resulted in an unclear record so that the district court could not accurately rely on that. And it does not support a finding of incompetency. Appellant's competency, according to Dr. Reitman, was completely unrestorable, and 3 months later was restorable. And again, as we've mentioned, that he testified, quote, what is the harm, end quote, in having appellant committed to a competency restoration program, even though this is contrary to how the process works, and it caused the district court to question Dr. Reitman's ultimate opinion. Mental illness does not automatically render a person incompetent to stand trial. Instead, there's a specific inquiry into the person's mental capacity and the capacity and their ability to consult with counsel, understand the proceedings, and participate in their defense. And for the foregoing reasons, the district court properly found that the evidence shows appellant had this mental capacity and was therefore competent to stand trial. I see I have a little time left, and unless this court has any more questions, I respectfully request the court affirm.
Thank you. Rebuttal, Mr. Kyle.
It's getting a workout today. So just briefly to address a couple things. First, FASD not necessarily is a mental health issue. FASD is a permanent disability. And in fact, the American Bar Association in 2018 passed a resolution requesting that courts and all those within the court proceedings learn and understand and deal with clients with FASD, because this is becoming a more prevalent issue. In fact, Dr. Bell, a psychiatrist from Chicago, recently wrote an article saying that FASD within the African-American community is the greatest public safety risk the African-American community has faced since slavery. This is an issue that is going to hit the doorstep very soon, in fact, is. Now, in terms—
Can I turn you back to the standard of review? I'm looking back at the syllabus in State v. Mills, where the Supreme Court, in crafting its own syllabus as to its holding, said the following, as the holding or syllabus, the point of law for the case. The trial court did not err in concluding that appellant was competent to stand trial, where the expert witnesses, number one, where the expert witnesses agreed that appellant did not suffer from a defect of reason, but disagreed, so they agreed as to that the appellant did not suffer from the defect of reason, but disagreed as to whether suffered from a personality disorder that would prevent her from effectively participating in her defense. If that's the context of what the court was saying about what is proper weight, it seems to me that in this case, if we apply it, then we would say that the district court perhaps did not err in concluding that appellant was competent, where you have the experts agreeing as to one thing but disagreeing as to another.
Well, I would disagree, because I think the record, what the court does is they say Dr. Federici testifies.
I'm just talking about the standard of review. I'm trying to get my mind around the bigger question of how we approach the case before we get to the question of what do we do with that, how do we apply it, how we actually apply it in these circumstances.
Well,
do you agree that the syllabus point does tend to shed some light on what the Supreme Court may have been referring to when it used the term proper weight?
To a certain extent. To me, the definition of proper weight is somewhat ambiguous, because it doesn't seem like this issue's really been litigated to as compared to like search and seizure. And the issue with this is that every individual is just different. So we all have mental health issues. The question is, what is it, what the severity is? And then in a criminal context, does it impair your ability to rationally consult with counsel or understand and participate in the proceeding? So that is the question. And I think the evidence that was presented at the district court level shows that appellant can't. He is acting between a 6 to 9-year-old without the capacity to learn. And in fact, so when you look at Reitman and Rogstad, they're forensic psychologists who are determining whether or not he's competent to proceed. But Dr. Federici is a clinical nurse, neuropsychologist who's been practicing for, I believe, over 30 years, and he's saying he can't learn. And in fact, he's just going to continue to deteriorate. And in fact,
So are you saying the district court didn't give proper weight to Dr. Federici's opinion?
And Dr. Reitman. So what the court says about Dr. Reitman is, well, his reports were conclusory, they were short, but that's the whole purpose of having an evidentiary hearing, because Reitman came in and testified as to his reports. So if the court was just looking at the record, you would essentially just stipulate to what the reports were, but we didn't. We had an evidentiary hearing where these experts came in and testified. And then Reitman, in fact, acknowledged and said, listen, the reason I mentioned the restoration program is not because I think he's going to be restored, but it's to put him in a functional setting where individuals would see him on a daily basis beyond the 2 to 3 hours that a forensic psychologist would view him, and see how he is in a natural setting, because that's where you're actually going to get your most scientifically valid results, by seeing whether or not he actually is malingering and whether he has the capacity to learn, whether he has the capacity to understand. And that's why he went out to the chemical dependency provider to get their opinion, because appellant had no reason to lie at his chemical dependency treatment. His goal was to get through it, but in order to get through it, he needed an aide. And why would he feign learning in a CD program? Because he's not going to graduate, likely, or there's going to be a longer term of the program. So with his individual aide said is he doesn't learn. He doesn't retain information. And that's why they were there. So with Reitman and Federici, the court doesn't give proper weight to them. And in fact, it seems like they just completely ignore them and says, well, Reitman's reports were conclusory, they were short, so therefore I can't give it weight. When in fact, Reitman testified at the hearing, not only once, but twice, because after Dr. Rogstad testified, he got up on the stand and testified again. So I see my time is out, so we'd ask the court to overturn the conviction. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Your briefs and arguments were very helpful here today, and we will look closely at the matter and issue our opinion within the statutory time.
Is this your first time? Feeling better now that it's over? Nice job.
Nice job by all counsel.
Glasses here.
Thank you.